Welcome to Uncharted Living. We're your hosts, Christine, Rebecca, and Ty. We are life coaches who are committed to the road less traveled. Join us each week for thought-provoking and entertaining conversations, all designed to help you create your own map. Uncharted Living. It's just the beginning. Don't be afraid to get life started. Jump off the map. Hello, fellow humans. Welcome back to Uncharted Living. A few episodes back, we spoke with my sister, Diana Sawyer, a registered hospice nurse, about dying. You, our listeners, had such a tremendous response to the episode that we knew we needed to bring her back to discuss more on this topic. In our first episode with Diana, Death Smiles at Us All, episode 11, we covered a lot of topics, including the certainty of death, what hospice is and isn't, complex family dynamics, how to care for yourself when someone you love is dying, and reimagining the perfect goodbye. And hint, it's not everyone sitting vigil at someone's bedside, holding hands and saying perfect words. Today, we are going to dive a bit deeper and discuss cultural differences regarding death, how to know when someone is nearing the end, and how we can show up in the process in uncharted, yet impactful, meaningful, and beautiful ways. Dee, welcome back to the podcast. Since we can't do our most favorite thing in the world together, which is being in person together, eating popcorn and peanut butter M&Ms while watching Tommy Boy, this is the next best thing. So welcome.
Welcome, Dee.
Hi, Diana.
Thank you for coming back.
Thank you. It's an honor to be back. I really appreciate it.
And Dee, on the last episode, you beautifully read some poetry at the beginning and the end of the episode, and our listeners really resonated with that, and we did as well. And I know you've got a little something to read to start us off as we talk about death in this episode. So whenever you're ready.
Thank you. What I'd love to start off with, since we're going to be talking a lot about the actual body, our bodies, as they near the end of death and the end of life, and then actually when they are dead. I wanted to read this poem written by Andrea Gibson. Andrea was diagnosed with cancer in their 40s. They're a prolific poet and activist, and wrote this poem in response to a belief system that holds that when a person dies, the soul misses the body. So they wrote this poem called Tincture. I'm going to read an excerpt of it. Imagine when a human dies, the soul misses the body, actually grieves the loss of its hands and all they could hold, misses the throat closing shy, reading out loud on the first day of school. Imagine the soul misses the stubbed toe, the loose tooth, the funny bone. The soul still asks, why does the funny bone do that? It's just weird. Imagine the soul misses the thirsty garden cheeks watered by grief, misses how the body could sleep through a dream. What else can sleep through a dream? What else can laugh? What else can wrinkle the smile's autograph? Imagine the soul misses each fallen eyelash, waiting to be a wish, misses the wrist screaming away the blade. What else could hold on so tightly to everything? What else could hear the chain of a swing set and fall to its knees? What else could touch a screen door and taste lemonade? What else could come back from a war and not come back, but still try to live, still try to lullaby? When a human dies, the soul moves through the universe trying to describe how a body trembles when it's lost, softens when it's safe, how a wound would heal given nothing but time. You understand? Nothing in space can imagine it. No comet, no nebula, no ray of light can fathom the landscape of awe, the heat of shame, the fingertips pulling the first gray hair and throwing it away. I can't imagine it, the stars say. Tell us again about goosebumps. Tell us again about pain.
Whew. That was a good one.
Thank you, Dee.
Yeah.
Wow.
So beautiful.
Yeah. And Andrea Gibson.
I highly recommend everyone get a copy of Andrea Gibson's poetry books. They are beautiful. So because we are talking about the body a lot in this episode, both practically and spiritually, can you let us know from your experience, what are the signs when someone is actually near death?
Absolutely. This is something I talk a lot about with families because this is really uncharted for most people. They often have not been around somebody who is dying. They've been around someone who's sick, and maybe they've been to a funeral and seen a body in an open casket. But that period in between that we consider actively dying is very uncharted for most people. So there's a lot of education that I really love to provide to families around this. So generally what we see, there is a progression of signs and symptoms. Of course, as in everything, everybody is an individual. Some people follow these this progression really neatly, so we know exactly when it's going to happen. And some people surprise us by lingering on much longer than we expected, or dying very quickly when we didn't really have the signs and symptoms to kind of mark our way. But in general, the things that we start to see, a person generally becomes less responsive. They're sleeping all the time. They might rouse a little when you move them, roll them to change them or clean them or give them medication. But they're going to become a lot quieter, a lot more inward, and eventually, generally speaking, stop speaking. They will start to have respiratory changes. So their breathing will start to become very irregular. They may take fast breaths all in a row and then no breaths for 5 seconds, 10 seconds. And everybody leans in and then they take a big gulp of air. This irregular pattern called Shine-Stokes breathing. We see circulatory changes. So the heart stops circulating to the entire body because it just can't afford to send blood everywhere when it's slowing down. So it will prioritize the vital organs and stop circulating as efficiently to the extremities. So the toes, the fingers, the insides of the elbows will start to turn like a reddish purplish. It's called mottling. And often these same areas will also start to feel very cold. It's not painful. It's just the circulation is slowing down and we're seeing the blood kind of start to pool in those areas. Another sign that we see is people will often spike a very high fever a couple days before they die. We don't really know why. It's one of the more mysterious ones. It seems to be some kind of last burst of energy through the body. Along those lines, we can see somebody have what we call a rally. This can either be really wonderful if you know what it is and you can maximize it, or it can be very tragic if you don't know what you're seeing. And what happens is a person who's been pretty unresponsive for a while suddenly sits up in bed, has a conversation with you, has a meal, and the family's like, we've turned a corner. This is amazing. And then the next day, maybe the day after that, they're gone. So we call this a rally. It's a sign for us generally that the person is actually close to the end. So what I mean by if you know that that's what it is, you can maximize that. They're awake. This might be a rally. Let's all have dinner around the bed tonight. If you don't know what it is, it can really be a sense of false hope and be very hard for people to say, yes, just yesterday he got up and answered the door. And we say, I know, that's what happens. We start to see the vital signs change. They, you know, usually the blood pressure goes very low, the heart rate goes very high. These are things that the family isn't really aware of, unless there's a nurse coming in regularly. Also, most people at this point are no longer swallowing. It's no longer safe to swallow. They've lost the ability to do so. They're lying in bed. It's not safe to give them anything to eat or drink. And that's okay. Many people struggle with letting go of feeding their loved ones because food is really, for most cultures, it's a sign of love and togetherness. For some people, it's a sign of rehabilitation. You have to eat. You have to get stronger. And in hospice care at end of life, we really consider food for pleasure, which means if somebody is hungry and can safely swallow and wants something, they can have it. We're not on diabetic diets anymore. We don't care about the vegetables. If he can swallow ice cream safely and he wants ice cream, he gets ice cream as often as he wants. Something cool about this that I wanted to share is that you'll often see in the home around this time, this sort of period of unresponsiveness, these little swabs. It's a little sponge on a stick. And they're used for mouth care, even if somebody's not at end of life. It's just a little sponge to clean out the mouth. And often people are dipping them in water to kind of help with that sense of dryness because a person's no longer drinking. Or they'll dip it in mouthwash or lemon juice to kind of freshen up that taste. Mm. What I love to tell families is, remember, it's just a sponge on a stick. You can dip that thing in anything. So if there is something that would give your loved one pleasure, if you can't imagine your mom without her morning coffee, but she's not drinking coffee and it's not safe for her to drink coffee, you can dip that swab in some coffee and drag it along her lips or her tongue or the inside of her cheek. Give her that taste. Give her that sensation, even though she can't really swallow it anymore. I had a family who there was a man who was dying in his 60s, and he had stopped drinking for the last 6 years to try to improve his health. Then he ended up getting cancer, and he had told his sister, if I'm not going to make it, I want to drink. And at the time that I came into the home, he was unresponsive. And I shared this with the family. I said, listen, guys, I said, I'll deny saying this. You can dip that sucker in a drink if you want. They said, bourbon? I said, sure, let's get it up there. So sure enough, I had been trying to clean out his mouth with water, with a swab, and he was clenching down. He very clear signal. He didn't want this. His friend dipped it in a little bit of bourbon, dragged it across his lips. He opened his mouth like, let me have some of that. And it was such a joy, unexpectedly joyful, celebratory moment. And they were all saying cheers to each other. And, you know, he's really not responsive, but he's participating and he's getting a little hit of joy. I had another family whose father was in his 90s. And I shared this with them and their eyes lit up. And they said, boy, he had a Manhattan every single night. It's been so weird to not see him have one. I'm like, swab him with a Manhattan. And they shared that one of their happiest memories was that they made Manhattans for everyone. They swabbed dad. They all enjoyed the moment. Obviously, it doesn't have to be alcohol, but it's a pleasure moment. And it's a way of acknowledging this person with their tastes and preferences and joys and rituals is still here for a little bit longer. Hmm. And what can we do to bring a little bit more joy for them right at the end?
God, I love that.
Because that's amazing, Dee.
And it's something, like you said, then everyone makes a Manhattan and then it calms everyone else down and you're sharing it with the person. And it maybe it just brings them back to themselves a little bit and just to be able for the family then to provide some joy to them, I think it's a beautiful thing. And I had zero idea that you can do this. I remember our grandmother and our grandfather, when our grandfather was sort of towards the end and she still wanted to like make him healthy meals and things like that. Mm-hmm. And someone said, who cares? Just give him the donuts. Yeah. Like if he wants a, you know, Hershey bar, give him a Hershey bar. But I never even thought about the last minute on the lips and the swabs and what a beautiful thing for a family to be able to do. And just for our listeners, you know, they don't need permission from the nurse to do that, right? Is this just something that if someone's in their truly final, this is something that they can do?
It's, you know, there may be more conservative nurses out there who would disagree with that. But when we share the philosophy that it's food and drink for pleasure, that's a way I think of providing pleasure. And what's really nice about it too, is that it's, a way of participating with the person and their body that is not clinical. It's not, it doesn't require wearing gloves. There's a lot of tasks involved in end-of-life care that a lot of family members struggle with. And that's okay. I understand that. There's some people that feel very nervous to be in a room with a dying person because they're like, that's not mom. That's not her. But if you can remember that it actually is still her and participate with her in something that she has loved, you know, it's sort of similar to people who read, you know, poems or scriptures to people who are dying and they feel them squeeze their hand. It's another way of bringing something of them to them. And I have seen it firsthand that it does bring people joy. So I really, I just remember, it's just a sponge. You can dip it in anything.
That's amazing, Diana. I mean, this is what we're here for, Uncharted Dying, right? That's the name of our episode. So everyone go, you know, dip these things in whatever you want. Yeah. I'm thinking like, how do I make chocolate liquid?
Yeah.
This is giving me a lot of ideas.
Something like that. Anything that will give them joy.
Amazing.
Yeah. It's just such a loving thing too. And it brings like a lightheartedness to a moment where, you know, this is part of our human process. Mm-hmm. And I think part of what I think, you know, so many people resist, and myself included, around even talking about this subject, it's so unknown, but also like it feels so heavy sometimes. So if we can bring these little things, can really maybe alleviate some of the pressure around that situation, that moment.
I think that's exactly right. And relieving that pressure allows for people to feel everything more fully, to allow yourself to laugh. It feels maybe forbidden to laugh, quote, at a time like this. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's still a family going through, friends going through something really tough. And we all need to laugh when things are tough. Or at the very least, if you can't laugh, we can be ourselves and acknowledge that they are themselves. Mm-hmm. Another story I love about kind of joy towards the end is I was at a death pronouncement visit, which I know we're going to talk about today. But I walked in, this woman had died. She had a bunch of, seven or eight kids, and they were all very task oriented, rushing around. They all had different roles, different comfort levels with being near the body, but all very like serious. What can we do? And I was helping them change their mother into new clothing. And she was a very, very religious woman. She had a rosary in her hands. There's a special kind of necklace that some very devout Catholics will wear. It has a picture of Jesus on the front and the back. Very, very devout Catholic woman. So I'm helping them get dressed. And one of the daughters, they were all very stressed, asking me questions, pulls me aside. And she says, "I have to ask you something." I said, "Okay." Had my kind of serious face on. She must be really anxious. She says, "My sister picked out this outfit, and my mother would not want to wear red underwear." And I just laughed out loud. I said, "Oh, you think she thinks that's going to look bad where she's headed next?" And she was like, "She can't wear red. She would not want this." I said that. And then she said this. And then we were all laughing, of course, because underwear is sort of inherently funny. And it was just sort of ridiculous, but also very poignant. And so that's fine. Get another pair. So they're going through the drawers. They're trying to find a pair that, well, no, that one looks faded. That one looks torn. And then invariably one of them would say, "We know it doesn't matter." They're sort of justifying to me. "We know it doesn't matter." And I said, "No, it does matter. This is your last memory of this. This is your experience of it. Does it actually matter in like a physical sense what clothing is on you? No, of course not. We all understand that intellectually. But in terms of thinking about this as an experience and as a moment, it does matter. And if you're gonna lie awake at night going, "I can't believe we put mom in red underwear," then you better change it out. And that is fine with us. We're here to honor what works.
It's an honoring too of that person, right? Of like,
yes.
They would, yeah.
And you know that daughter, I'm sure in her retelling now is like, "I'm the one who saved mom from showing up to heaven in some like indecent floozy underwear." And you know what? whatever happened after the fact is sort of irrelevant. It mattered to her, and it made a big difference to her. But it just reminded, you know, then they were all laughing. And I remember looking around thinking how good it felt to see them all laughing and how it was okay for them to be laughing. And then actually after that moment, they were all more eager to participate in some of the parts of the visit that they wouldn't normally. I think it kind of loosened everybody up and opened everybody up in a really beautiful way.
Mm. Mm. So Dee, can you tell us more? I don't even really know what you mean when you say death pronouncement.
Yes. So I will tell you what this means. So we all watch TV shows and movies. Somebody's in a hospital and they die, and then a doctor comes in and looks at a a watch and they do a couple things to the person and then they say time of death 5:40. That's a death pronouncement.
Okay.
So in a, yeah, absolutely. No, Uncharted. Why would you know what this is? So in a hospital setting, a doctor has to be the person to pronounce. In a hospice care setting, a registered nurse or a nurse practitioner can pronounce. So I and my colleagues pronounce people dead all the time. It's part of our job. So when we're caring for a family, we say, when your loved one passes, you call us, don't call 911. We will come and do the pronouncement. So what we do is I am called to the home. I walk in and I always start with education and explain what's going to happen. Because usually people are pretty shocked. Not necessarily shocked the person died, but like, we have a dead body in the house. What's going to happen next? Yeah. It's very uncharted, right? So I always start with, you know, I'm so sorry. Sometimes I acknowledge if I've been involved in the care before and I had just seen them, I will acknowledge, man, this felt too fast, didn't it? Or, oh, I'm so sorry. He's too young. This isn't fair. You know, I just try to acknowledge the reality of what I think they're all feeling. Or if the person is very old and the family seems apologetic, you know, they'll say, I know she was 98, whatever. And I will say, but it would never be enough time, right? It would never feel like enough time with somebody that you love, right? So I try to at least show that I see what they're going through. And then I tell them what I'm going to do, which is I'll give you my educational spiel here. Is I say I'm going to go in. I'm going to put my stethoscope on their chest. I'm going to listen for a full minute and confirm that I don't hear a heartbeat. I'm also going to make sure there's no breathing, no kind of responses, and confirm that they're really gone. And then what I will do is I'll look at my watch, and that is the time that I will write down for, there's a death pronouncement form, and then that's the time that will go on their death certificate. Even though they may have died an hour, 2 hours before that, it's the time that whoever's pronouncing announces the time. I don't say it out loud because it's ridiculous. I just look and I say, yep, they're gone. Something else that I do, and this is just my own quirk, it's not technically part of the job, but I can't really stop myself from doing it, is I always stroke the person's head after, right after I've pronounced them. I stroke the person's forehead, and I will say, goodbye, my friend. God bless you on your journey. I say it every time. I don't know what compels me to say it. And it's really interesting because most family members have a moment you can kind of hear them inhale a little bit. It catches them by surprise. I think it's just a nice acknowledgement of, I don't know where the you has gone. I'm looking at your body. But I wish you well, and I wish you peace. And it's also another part of the reason why I don't mind using the word past. Some people think or rail against that. They think that it's kind of shying away from the truth. It's too soft. We don't pass away, we die. And that's fair. I respect that perspective. But to me, passing, like a passage, is active. And what I see is a change in something. Some part of this person has left, whether it is snuffed out like a match or it lives on for eternity or it comes back. Whatever happens next, it is a passage. It is a journey. And so I actually don't mind the word pass. So I will use that. So after I've officially pronounced them, I fill out a form that the funeral home will use. I will make sure I know what funeral home the family is going to use, which is why I like to have asked that far in advance so that when we're in this moment, we're not scrambling. And then I will call the funeral home, let them know to come. And then we will begin sort of addressing the actual body. So I will offer to do what's called post-mortem care, which is giving the person a final bed bath, cleaning them, changing their clothes, brushing their hair, which seems to mean a lot when we have women who have died and their family has kind of regretted seeing them, their hair flattened. You know, we can brush it, pull it back in a clip. I'll shave a man's face if he's used to being clean shaven, but you know, someone will say, you shave a dead body. I'm like, yeah, because then when his spouse sees him and says, oh, he looks like himself again. I mean, what a gift, you know, and it's such an easy thing to do. So these kind of care activities are really interesting. I always invite the family to participate if they would like to, and then I give them a lot of permission not to if they don't want to. Everybody is very different on this point. Some people seem nervous, like they want to be the kind of person that would do that. So I'll say, you know, you could start and then you could just leave if it's too much. That's okay. I'll also say it's okay if you want to be in the other room. And then I'll go as so far as to say the decision you make about this moment does not negate all the other moments you have already had with this person. It's not a reflection of your love for them if you're not comfortable being in the room and actually cleaning their body with me. It doesn't mean that you don't love them. It doesn't mean you're not strong. It's just people have different comfort levels.
Wow.
I know that the people who stay and help are surprised at how cathartic it feels and how sacred it feels to wash a dead body. Most dead bodies in our care are not like ghoulish, garish things like TV. They're not gruesome. It looks usually just like a person sleeping with very pale skin. So I think once people kind of get more comfortable with being in the room with them, then they get a little bit more comfortable. Well, maybe I could take a washcloth and just wipe her face. And as we get more into it, then they'll say things like, I'm really glad I'm doing this. I feel really good doing this. Mm. And if they don't, that's okay too. But it is a very sacred moment. I love doing it for families if they are open to it and if they want me to. And it just allows another moment with the body. So when we're doing that, whether or not the person – now, whether or not the family is helping me or not, I always make it a point to talk to the body, talk to the person. I'll say, okay, my friend, I'm going to just wash your back now. You're feeling my cloth on your hand. Oh, sorry, I dripped a little. I didn't mean to. Or if I'm struggling to get their pants back on, I say, I'm so sorry. I'm doing this so rough. I know that they're not really feeling the things that I'm doing. I'm a nurse. I know that. And also, it feels strange to not talk to a human body that's in the room with you. Mm. And there's a little part of me that wonders, I don't know what has happened to the being that was them. I don't know. Like I said, is it snuffed out? Did it go straight into some afterworld? Is it hovering here for a little while? I don't know. I don't want to sound too mystic about it, but I just don't know. I mean, it's a mystery. We don't know. We haven't done it. I tell this to my families all the time. The person dying knows more about death than we do. We're helping them, but we haven't done this before, so we don't know what they're going through. So I like to keep that humility in mind and talk to them. And I feel like when the families are with me and they hear me talking to them, it lightens them up a little bit, loosens them up a little bit. We can still call her by her name. We can say, all right, Shirley, I'm going to brush your hair. We're going to get you cleaned up now. Oh, you look so much like yourself again. You look so beautiful. And I'll also talk to them if I'm alone doing the postmortem care, which is very hard to do alone. There's a reason for the expression dead weight. It doesn't move. So you, as the nurse, are really struggling by yourself to turn this person, get them cleaned up. So I'll say, come on, Harry, you got to help me out, man. I'm by myself in here. And
help her out, Harry.
Come on, man.
Don't be such dead weight.
Yeah, exactly. And I do it not to be irreverent, but to sort of be more intimate, you know? This,
right.
I'm a body. There's a body here. We're kind of doing this thing together. And I do feel it's a way that I feel comfortable continuing to have respect and dignity for this person is by continuing to address them and using their name and not acting like they're already just forgotten.
Diana, are you frequently the only nurse professional there on site?
For a pronouncement visit?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So the only time I wouldn't be is if they were currently having a visit with their home health aide who was already helping give them a bath right before they died. Or if, you know, if another nurse, there's another nursing level, LPNs, and if they're there for the visit, LPNs are not allowed to pronounce. So then they might call the RN. But generally speaking, I'll be the only person that's there from the hospice or the care team.
So then probably everybody has their own way. I mean, you're telling us your way, but if you have this situation in your home, it mm-hmm. could be any flavor of the hospice nurse.
Yes. That's a great point. That's a great point. This is how I like to address it, but I am just one person.
I'd really like you for all of my, can you be my on-call?
Can we request him now?
Yeah. When Grammy died back in March, and you're in Boston, and my other sister and I got called. She was living in a home or in a private home, and they like made us stay in the room, and it was so weird because there she is, and then right next to her is this other little woman who I actually also thought was dead, but was not dead. And occasionally she would raise her arm. And I just had, it was so weird. And then I'm staring at her and I had just seen her a few days beforehand and she had, grasped my hand and all of that. But it was so weird just waiting. And there were nurses, but they were, what you were describing is not at all what happened. And
so, Christine, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
When you say they made you stay, who's the they?
Oh, sorry. The people that are the aides that live at the home with.
So your grandmother was already in a nursing home.
She was in a private,
group home.
Like a group home. So it was a private house, like in a neighborhood. So just like a regular house in a neighborhood. And then she shared a room with someone. So we got the call and my parents were not in town. And, so my sister and I that lived down here, got the call. And so we went over and we had to just kind of be in this little room. No one said to me, all they said to us was, I'm sorry. They didn't say anything about anything. And we just had to kind of wait there until I guess the funeral home guy came, and then I didn't want to touch the body, and I and my other sister was there like holding her hand and stroking her hand and crying and all of that. And I had a really hard time with it. I was like, I do not want to be in here. I do not want to be sitting here. I do not, we were so close to the bed. And then, and then I thought that she was breathing. So, she was wearing like a patterned shirt. And I think I just was like, are you sure she's dead? Are you like, cause that's kind of a fear of mine. Yes. Like, when you hear the people of they're actually still alive. And I was like, I think she's alive. And the nurse basically told my youngest sister, here's a mirror, and made my sister, poor Julie, Diana, I'm going to have to pay for her therapy, and made Julie go and stand over her mouth with a mirror so that she could see, and then tell me so that I would be okay that she actually wasn't breathing. That was the hospice nurse we got. This is a lot different. And we were both.
Okay. Wait. Yes. Can I pause us here? So what we're saying is that this is truly uncharted territory for everyone in this scenario, right? Like this is, unless you're in this world on a regular basis, you don't know what you're supposed to do or what you can opt out of. So what we're saying here by highlighting both of these spectrums is you still have agency over your own involvement in the process. If you have a hospice nurse, right? Or someone there is what we're highlighting.
Yeah, you should have agency. And I guess I would hope that your listeners will take that to heart, that you can make any choice that you want as far as how comfortable you are being involved, being present in the room. And if somebody doesn't offer you that choice, there's nothing wrong with saying, I'm going to wait in the other room. I'm not really comfortable being in here. That happens a lot. I walk into homes where the person greets me and they say, you know, my daughter, my sister, whoever is not going to come out. They're having a hard time. They don't want to be here. I've had spouses too, who will be there while I do the pronouncement, but then they say, I don't want to be here when the funeral home comes to take the body. And I'll say, okay, they're going to be here in an hour. I'll let you know. At our agency, we always offer to the family if they would like us to wait with them until the funeral home comes. That's an option they have. Sometimes people want that. And sometimes they're okay. They have enough of their own family around them. They usually will just want to know what is actually going to happen. And what usually happens is the funeral home, the people from the funeral home will come, or the cremation service, whoever's being used. When I call them, have to give them a little info on what we're dealing with. Are we going upstairs? Is the doorway going to be wide enough for a stretcher? Is this person a bariatric patient and they're going to need to send a couple extra people? Is there anywhere to park? I don't have to go into a ton of info, but basically anything they'll want to know. If the person has died sitting up in a recliner and we didn't get there for a few hours, that's something the funeral home needs to know, because they're going to have to transport them in a very different way, because the body will start to kind of freeze up.
You mean they won't lie down?
Oh, wow.
Body itself is kind of frozen in a, in a more upright position.
So if you fall asleep sitting, die sleeping, sitting up in a recliner, and nobody moves you, your body is going to firm up in that position. Mm. And then it will be up to the funeral home, the people who work beyond what I do. Obviously, if the body is going to be in a casket or in an open casket, they will figure out a way to sort of loosen up the body, stretch it out. I don't really know what they do, to be honest. I don't know if they break bones. But what I imagine, though, is that it's not pleasant for the family to see. So what I like to do is just give the funeral home a heads up. Hey, she's kind of sitting in a reclined position. So figure out what you're going to need to do. And then I will let the family know sometime. If I have time, I'll say, let's just lower the head of the bed. Let's just get her flat so that it might be a little easier to transport her. If that's not an option, I will just say to them, listen, because they're kind of upright, they may have to take her out a different way. So if you want to go in the other room for that, that's totally fine. So
Diana, are you usually still there when the mortuary people come?
It's like 50% of the time. It depends if the family wants me to stay or not. If it's a little 86-year-old spouse by herself in the house and her husband just died, I will always stay with that little old lady. Mm-hmm. If there's 15 people in the house and they're supporting each other, I'll offer, do you want me to stay? And they're like, no, we're fine. We have each other. But often I am there. And generally, the ones that I've witnessed, everyone, of course, every experience is different, as we've heard from Christine's one-star review of hospice.
Oh, gosh.
So many follow-ups.
Yeah.
But generally what happens is, and I will explain this to the family too, they're going to come in, they're going to bring a stretcher, put it right next to the bed, and then they're going to pull the person onto the stretcher using the sheets, you know, kind of like you've seen in a movie too, of being transferred, you know, onto an emergency room table or something. And then they put a covering over the stretcher. I will say, at least in the funeral homes and cremation services we work with, they have this lovely tradition now of, it's not always just the black cover over the thing that looks like a grill cover when they're taking the stretcher out. They have like,
I know what you mean.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Is it on TV? Everything I know is from TV. Yeah.
Exactly. This is why I have to help you help break it down. But they have these lovely kind of alternatives now that I've seen a lot of homes do, is they will have a covering or a zip thing that it looks like a quilted blanket, or it looks like another sheet, but something that looks a little bit more soft, a little bit more familiar, a little bit less clinical and sterile. I worked with a funeral home recently. They were lovely. After they took her out, I went back into the room and they had placed a rose on the bed, which I thought was just a really nice touch. That's not required, but that's just a really nice, again, just another way of respecting and dignifying, this person was here. It's a really, if you get the right people, and I've met a lot of really amazing people between hospice, doctors, funeral home directors. I had one funeral home director tell me that he sees his work as like a ministry. And we were both like, oh, I'm so grateful for what you do. I couldn't do that part. And I was like, what? I can't do what you do. Your part is the wild part. And he just said, yeah, I think we're just, it's a ministry. And we both agreed that it was a real privilege to be able to do what we do. Because the death pronouncement visit is very, very sacred. It's sort of unforgettable for everybody.
Well, the funeral home guy that took Grammy said that he is a part-time stand-up comedian and that he practices his stand-up routines while he's transporting the bodies because they're a captive audience and they're not going to tackle him.
One star. But on the heels of the one star, Christine, what I'm hearing is for our listeners, we can provide you with some agency during these times, because this kind of reminds me of like a birth plan and everybody has a birth plan. And a lot of what I've heard is you need to really stand up for yourself in the hospital during your birth. If you choose to have a child in a hospital, there's a lot of rights that you have that you really need to be coached. Like you don't just have to do what the doctor or the nurse who you might not even have met before says. And that's what I'm hearing in Christine's story is it's scary, but am I right when saying like, you do not have to hold the mirror up to your own grandmother's nose? Like, maybe that's what you want to do and that's cool. But maybe that's not like, maybe you're Christine and you're like, oh my God. So Dee, is that correct? Am I thinking about that the right way?
Yeah, I do. I think it's being willing to advocate for yourself and your family. Say, I'm not really comfortable doing that. Or I don't really want to hear about your stand-up comedy right now. Like being able to say, no, thank you. To anything that's happening. It's so interesting because I like to think that most of us in this field have really wonderful intentions. So when I hear that story about the nurse in the mirror, I think, I bet what she was thinking was, if I involve them in the process, let them see for themselves so that they don't have to just wonder what I did. But there's a way to do that, to say, you know what? Let's have another listen. Do you want to listen in my stethoscope? Will it make you feel better to do it yourself? Or do you just want me to confirm? Because I can confirm she's gone. But if it will make you better, feel better to like hold the instrument and see for yourself, no problem. And for some people, they really want to be present and see and know. It's a lot. There's a real lack of like therapeutic communication there going on. So that's really unfortunate. But you do have agency. It's your time. And we tell our families too, when your loved one dies, call us, but you don't have to call us right away. If you want to wait till your family gathers, if you want to sit with them for a couple hours, fine. It's your time. It's your person. Call us when you're ready. We'll come.
Unless they're in a chair. Unless they're sitting in a chair.
Then call them flat.
If they're in a chair, try to get them flat. And it's fine. The people that work in the funeral home and cremation industry, they know how, you know, just lift them out a different way. But I like to always think about, how are these last moments going to be perceived by the family watching them? And also, how much dignity can we still preserve for this person, even up to the moment that they are put into the back of the van to go to the funeral home? And any opportunity we have to acknowledge that the person is still a person among us, that their body is still there, to provide respect and dignity to that body, and to remember that this family, this is their experience that they are going to take with them. And so we want to sort of get it right. We have a sort of an expression that some of us think about, which is, we have one shot at a good death. And a good death is a person who dies comfortably, free from pain, and a family who feels that their loved one was cared for and respected, and that the family feels loved and cared for and respected. That's a good death. Even if it's hard and it's sad, there's a difference between a good death and sort of a bad death. And I personally believe that all of those moments, even after the actual death, are part of that, because that's all going to be part of the memory. I mean, Christine is still talking about those little parts of it. And because she's never going to forget them. That's the memory that she's left with. And she's, you know, she has a great sense of humor, so she's laughing at it, but also how awful.
It was.
So, but
it kind of underscores your lawyer side too, Christine, where you were like, prove it. Like, I'm going to need to see Grammy is like, 100%. We've got some evidence here, you know?
I think it's a fair question, because even as the nurse, sometimes I panic. The body, you can't believe how quiet it is after death. And we're used to listening to everything with our stethoscopes. We listen to the heart. We listen to the lungs. We listen for your belly should be gurgling. So putting a stethoscope on a dead body is really strange, because it's just silent and it's so quiet that if I'm holding the stethoscope, I can actually hear my own pulse going through. So sometimes I'll put the stethoscope down and I'll hear something and I'll freak out and I'll try to balance it on like a flatter part of their chest and take my hand off it so that I'm not. But then sometimes I can even hear, it's like the pulse of my, you know, ringing through my ears a little bit. So, you know, I do like to really double and triple check. I'll check their eyes, see if their pupils are fixed and dilated. I'll feel their pulse on their wrist. You know, usually, you know, right away, but it's scary, right? You don't want to mess that up. So, I think it was fair for you to ask that. And I think it was, unfair the way that, it was responded to.
Well, I made Julie deal with it. So,
but she's paying for her therapy. So fair.
Oh my gosh. Well, one of the questions that we have for you, Diana, has to do with like cultural differences around death and how we handle dead bodies. What have been some of your experiences around some of the differences in, like, you know, cultural expectations and desires?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I'll preface it by saying that very similar to our question from the last episode about generational differences is that ultimately everybody is still individual and every family is individual, and no one person or one family represents the entire XYZ community or religion or ethnic background. So all through nursing school and even continuing, we have a lot of like, you know, cultural sensitivity training, trying to understand what may be important. And even knowing some of that, you walk into a house and you're like, this family doesn't act like that at all. So that's my caveat, is everyone is still very different. Having said that, there's a couple that might be more well known. A lot of our Jewish families, they do not allow the body to be cremated, which came up interestingly because I was working with a Jewish family who actually did want the body to be cremated. And so it was a challenge. They needed to find a Jewish funeral home that would work with them and that would still consent to the body being cremated. And they had specific reasons for being cremated that I don't know. But that's a pretty common one, and a kind of a well-known one. Some of the differences we see nearing end of life, in the area where I live, in the sort of outside of Boston, we have a lot of Portuguese speaking families. So families that hail from Brazil or Portugal. What I've seen a lot of in these families is that it's sort of loyalty to your family and keeping them alive as long as possible is paramount. And so we often see a real resistance to hospice care because it feels like, and I've had lengthy conversations through translators on this topic saying, you're not failing your mother. You're not killing. They'll say, I feel like I'm killing her. And you're not killing her. She's dying. Mm. The disease is killing her. We can make her comfortable, but we don't want to keep bringing her to the hospital. And that becomes a real, I don't even want to say challenge. It's just something we have to really work together on, because there's always an instinct in certain families to treat everything, go back to the hospital.
So you're saying that the idea of having hospice like is kind of declaring we're losing?
Yes. We're not even that we're living, what we're giving up. If I
that's pretty common, I think.
Yeah, it
can be. But often we see families are able to sort of once they have then accepted that, and then we're in that hospice setting, we're all working together. There are certain cultural differences that we see with some families who continue to sort of not clash. That's not the wrong word. I don't want to paint this negative, but we have to kind of continually educate and then also ask them, listen, this is fine, but maybe you don't want to do hospice. If you want to keep going to the doctor and you want to keep, that is your prerogative. We respect your wishes, of course. And you need to, we'll always say, you need to feel good about this. So if you feel like you're giving up or you're failing or you're killing them, then nothing's going to feel good and we're not going to be able to work well together. Mm. So that's kind of something. And then we see sort of culturally, any culture that really tends to be very strong identifying with their culture. In the Boston area, it's a lot of Italian families, a lot of Irish families. And what's interesting is that it might not necessarily affect how we go through the process, but it creeps up a lot in the discussion. Well, you know, we're Italian, so X, Y, Z. Well, we're tough and Irish, so X, Y, and Z. And it actually doesn't have to do with anything, but it's sort of a way, I think, of claiming a little more agency over the situation and, again, giving yourself freedom and permission to act and speak and respond in a way that feels right for you. And sometimes that is very much defined by your culture, and sometimes it's not. Religious differences play a factor as well. Whether or not people have a strong faith system in any faith system or not, either is okay. But that will affect the way that people kind of talk about things. I'm not an expert in all the individual cultures by any means. Everyone's ultimately an expert kind of in themselves and how they embody the cultures that they're from. So the most important thing for us is just to be aware of it and to kind of call out for other members of our team what we might see with this particular family that we all need to be aware of, be respectful of, and try to work together.
Well, we are honored to have Steph, our producer, and we're going to ask her to just pop on because I know that she's had some experience with this with respect to end of life and death. And Steph, if you don't mind popping in and telling us your story, I think our listeners would really benefit from it.
I also think it's important to mention that Steph lives in this country of Colombia. So
yes,
take that into, you know, the cultural landscape. But yes. Thanks, Steph. Thanks for being here.
Of course. So to give you guys some context, I'm from the Jewish community in Colombia. So that makes it a very unique experience. It's a very, very small community. Is an aged community. I'm currently 33 years old, but I am an active member of the Hebra Kadisha. The Hebra Kadisha is an organization that takes place after what we just heard. So we work as a mortician part of the system, sort of, but we have definitely a different approach to it and a very emotional approach to it. So we do, it's all volunteer work. So none of us get paid at all. And what we do is we get the bodies ready for burial. We do have, as everything in the Jewish tradition, a lot of laws regarding how this is supposed to go. I honestly started this process because I was afraid of death. And is getting closer by my parents, and it's getting closer to, you know, life. So I decided to step into this experience. And basically how it works is we get called as soon as the person dies. And what you were saying about when they die in any different position or in the laying out is very complicated to manage. Wow. So we get called, and then we take them to the synagogue. The synagogue has special places where we bathe them. We go through the Tahara, which is a ritual, and we do a bunch of prayers. But basically, the experience is to get them ready for burial. We have very strict rules of how that happens. We bathe them. That's basically what we do with water. Specifically, we place dirt of Israel in their eyes and in some other specific area. So it's very symbolic. The whole thing is very symbolic. And that's why we have only Jewish people do it to Jewish people. And that's part of the law. A Jewish body can never be alone with anyone that is not Jewish, supposedly. So there always has to be someone at least around. There's usually four of us. Women do women, men do men. And yes, most of the members of the Hevra Kalisha are very, very old people. So that's kind of what we decided to jump in, because it requires strength, to say the least. Have to be very strong to manage the body. It gets incredibly, incredibly heavy. It's not at all kind of odd experience. At the beginning it is, because we're not used to deal with a body in an everyday basis. But it really comes from a place of love and respect. And like you were saying, Diana, it's impossible not to talk to them. It's impossible. It's like, I'm sorry, I need to move you this way. I need to do this. It's like kind of asking for consent as you go. But it's very much a labor of love. And I have become some sort of a big enthusiast of how, as you were, the sound of silence, the silence of the death is a very specific sound, and it's not a sound specifically, but you know what I mean. It has different components. So when you go out again into the world, you see it a little bit different. You see it vibing in a different way. And I think nothing has taught me more about life than death.
Do the family members of the person who's died help with the bathing, or is it all just,
non-family? No, it's members? Just us usually. There's needs to be four people for managing all of the bathing. Because we have a technical part when you actually need to remove all the impurities and all of that. And there is a ritual side of it, where we're very much connected to water in the Jewish community, and we have, even when you menstruate, and all of the connections with death are very closely related to water. So we have another separate bath that it's more of a symbolic one. So it's very hard to manage. They usually don't see their family member after they say bye at home. They won't see them again, because we do put some garments on as soon as they left the site or the synagogue to get buried. There's no some sort of watching the body or accompanying the body by other family members. They only accompany the body when we're not there. So that would be the only situation where they are kind of dealing with it.
And the burial has to happen how soon after death?
As soon as possible.
As soon as possible.
Okay. So everything needs to happen as soon as possible. So when we finish up the, getting the body ready and getting everything set, they take them right to the cemetery, to the burial place, where they have to bury it as soon as possible. And more of the rituals about death are more related to the people that are left. So we call them, I don't know how to say that in English, we call them the deudos in Spanish. And are the people like your, if they were mothers or their partner and kids, those like close tight circle, everything is more focused on them than in the body.
Yeah. Is that also then when there's sitting Shiva for
yes.
time after?
Yes. We enter the Shiva process, which is 7 days.
7 days.
Yeah. And that is the lengthiest part of the burial sort of, you know, ritual. But it's totally focused on them. We understand that the body is just a vehicle, and that's why we don't play as long, like a long devotion to the body. Mm. We just kind of wrap it and go, you know. And here in Colombia, for example, people do like they leave the body for like 2 days in a specific space, and people go and they kind of chill around the body. We don't do that. We kind of take the body as soon as we can to the burial place.
Yeah.
We don't cut them open or anything like that. So it's nothing medically related. When we clean, we just clean the outside of the body. Mm-hmm. And yeah, we just make sure they are the person that they say they are and that sort of thing. But that's why it only can happen if the death was natural.
And Steph, I'm so curious as to what has your family commented on your new hobby?
That's some exposure therapy right there.
Because maybe I'm wrong, but most of your family isn't Jewish, correct?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So do they understand this? This is pretty uncharted as a pastime.
Actually, they do, because on my mom's side specifically, my grandmother used to do this in her neighborhood. I didn't know about that until few months ago. I knew that. So apparently it runs in the family. So yes, my mom was super moved by it. And my mom has had a very close relationship to like, you know, dealing with dying people, and it really like sparks empathy on her. So she was really very like moved that I decided to take the test specifically because of her mother. So no, they were all very like, wow. They kind of all see it coming for some reason.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Thanks for sharing that. Yeah. That's so interesting.
Of course.
Well, one of the things you both sort of highlighted, Steph, your comment on like, nothing has prepared me for life more than death. Mm-hmm. It just like rings so true. And also, Dai, when you were talking about just like incorporating some of their, like some of whoever is laying here in front of us, right? Some of their traditions or their routines, their habits, even like the coffee and maybe cocktail. It's like, it almost breathes life into what we're doing right now today. For those of us who are here, for everyone listening, it's like being so present with some of those little things. It's this conversation, I think, really speaks to that and kind of highlights life and living and honoring this process that we're all going through. So thank you both for coming on and sharing these really amazing viewpoints on something that we're all going to experience, and we're all going to experience it in different ways before even we're ready to pass in that way ourselves. Mm-hmm. So we really appreciate it. Thank you both so much. And everyone listening at home, you can find Diana. We've got all the links in our show notes to her blog, which is freaking incredible. She's a wonderful writer. And then everything that we referenced throughout the episode. So if you want more information to be able to really, this is an act of service for the community, an act of service and an act of love for family, to educate ourselves on the process and so that we can die well. And I don't know, I just feel so much love for all of you and for all of the listeners. So it's really kind of highlighted that for me today. Thank you all so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Dee.
Thank you guys. All. Bye.
Bye. Thank you so much for spending another week with us. Follow us at Uncharted Living Podcast on Instagram and TikTok. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any episodes. And please like and share this episode with your favorite fellow human.